Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is James Galvin, a professor of history at UCLA. His research focuses on the Middle East, particularly Greater Syria, the part of the present-day Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Israel, and the Palestinian territories. He's the author of Divided Loyalties, Nationalism and Mass Politics in Syria at the Close of Empire, The Modern Middle East, A History, and his latest book is The Arab Uprisings, What Everyone Needs to Know. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Galvin.
Thank you, Ian.
And I'm beginning to wonder here, we were just talking about U.S.-Russian cooperation over Ukraine and what issues that they're working on, which might restrain both parties from getting into a new Cold War. But as far as working together on Syria, it does look as though the Russians and the Assad government in Syria have taken the U.S. to the cleaners. We've been had. I think John Kerry's more or less suggested that as much. I think about 4% of the chemical weapons, have only 4% have been turned in.
Right. Assad has asked for another 100 days. The inspectors don't think that's necessary. But of course, he will remain in power so long as the inspections go on and the removal takes place. He's absolutely necessary to pinpoint where these things are, and he knows this full well. The Russians know this full well as well. So there's plenty of reason for him to stall on the chemical weapons.
And apparently, in terms of these unproductive talks in Geneva between the Assad government and the Syrian opposition, now the State Department is complaining that the Assad government are retaliating against Syrian opposition representatives to the Geneva peace talks by arresting their family members.
Well, the talks themselves were always a long shot for the United States. That being said, of course, the United States has no other options at the present time. American policy is focused on the idea that we can't let Syria turn into another Libya. We can't let Syria have a hard fall. There has to be a soft landing for Syria. And in order to ensure that that takes place, there's got to be some sort of negotiated settlement. Now, that is very likely not going to take place, but it's the only way in which the American policy can actually be implemented. And it does put us at a certain amount of mercy of the Syrian regime on the one hand and the Russians on the other hand. What we have to do is we have to make sure that the Syrian regime continues to negotiate, that it has to work in good faith, that the Russians put pressure on it, on the regime itself. So, therefore, the United States doesn't have very many cards that it can play at the present time. Now, the difference between Obama and McCain is that Obama probably realizes that the United States has been had, but can't really do anything about it. And McCain realizes that the United States has been had and wants the United States to do some futile gesture that would try to shift things around. It's not going to work.
In other words, you know, send over a few cruise missiles and rattle the rubble.
Something like that. But, I mean, the problem, of course, is that nobody except a very, very slight grouping within the Senate is in favor of something like that. If you look at the American population, more Americans think that Congress is doing a good job than want to intervene in any way in Syria. So it's a very, very unpopular thing. Obama realizes this. McCain probably realizes this as well, which allows him to strike a heroic pose in spite of the fact that it would have no effect anyway.
Well, meanwhile, on the rebel side, it looks worse and worse. This group, ISIS, who are antediluvian, it looks as though, they're now in the area of northern city of Raqqa that they control. They're now levying attacks against Christians that goes back to the Dima in the Quran, where they're insisting on half an ounce of pure gold in exchange for the safety of the Christians.
I think we can read what's going on in terms of ISIS in multiple ways. I mean, you're absolutely right. These guys are barbaric, but they're so barbaric that what's gone on is they've turned much of the Syrian population against them. What you have now is you have Islamic fighters, members of the Syrian Islamic Front, who are fighting not only against ISIS, as well as against the regime. But you also have, for example, Jabhat al-Nusra, which is the official affiliate of al-Qaeda in Syria. And al-Qaeda now is so unpopular in Syria, that what Jabhat al-Nusra has had to do is to get rid of much of the ideological trappings of al-Qaeda. So they say now that they're fighting to overthrow the Assad regime. They say that their interests are only Syria. Al-Qaeda's interests, of course, al-Qaeda doesn't believe in nation states, doesn't believe in Syria. So in order to be able to maintain their popular base, Jabhat al-Nusra has to get rid of the ideology that is the only thing that binds al-Qaeda together. In the same way, what they've done is they've promised areas that they've liberated that they're not going to act in the way that ISIS has acted as well. So what we see now going on is splits within al-Qaeda-type factions. What we see is large parts of the opposition fighting against al-Qaeda, the Syrian Islamic Front, the Free Syrian Army, the various Kurdish factions as well. So there are people who say that this has demonstrated that al-Qaeda is on the rebound, that the Syrian uprising has been very good for al-Qaeda. I think it's just demonstrated just the opposite.
Again, I'm speaking with James Gelvin, a professor of history at UCLA. His research focuses on the Middle East, particularly Greater Syria, the area of present-day Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Israel, and the Palestinian territories. And he's the author of Divided Loyalties, Nationalism, and Mass Politics in Syria at the Close of Empire, The Modern Middle East, A History. And his latest book is The Arab Uprisings, What Everyone Needs to Know. But al-Nusra also just suffered a pretty devastating defeat on the battlefield. A lot of their fighters were ambushed by Assad's forces. There have been reports for some time now indicating that Assad basically leaves the really extreme people alone, like ISIS, and either goes after the Free Syrian Army or the moderate groups. So where would al-Nusra fit into that?
Well, al-Nusra is trying to situate itself between the so-called more moderate factions, including the Syrian Islamic Front and the Free Syrian Army on the one hand, and ISIS on the other hand. So what they've tried to do is set themselves up as leading negotiations amongst the factions. We should not lose sight of the fact, however, that Jabhat al-Nusra is al-Qaeda. They've been officially recognized by Zawahiri as being the official franchise of al-Qaeda in Syria. And so, therefore, these people, you know, we can't look at them as being moderate in any way. They have just shifted a bit in terms of what their ideology is. But we would be no better off if they won than if ISIS won.
So the agony is just going to continue? Is that the prognosis? I saw an extraordinary picture of as far as the eye could see, just a sea of people crowded into this devastated, narrow street, heading out apparently in a moment where there was an amnesty. They were just getting out of the war zone. These are the people that have been caught in the crossfire. It was truly a disturbing image.
Yes, it's very likely going to continue without a break at this point. The government feels that it has the upper hand, so the government is going to continue using the sort of weaponry that we've seen in Aleppo, for example, barrel bombs and what have you, in a terror campaign. What they will not be able to do is to remove the opposition from much of the countryside. So what we're going to see is the government are going to retake the cities, the most important areas in the west of Syria, but very likely what's not going to happen is that they're going to be able to take back large chunks of the rural areas and the Far East as well. So at best what will happen is we settle into some sort of stalemate. Now, while we're focused on that, we should also understand that the Geneva option is not foreclosed, not entirely foreclosed at the present time. What the United States undoubtedly is doing is working around the edges of Geneva and of these various things. There's been all sorts of, for example, rumors that the United States has been meeting with Iran and with the Assad government in Bern, the capital of Switzerland, for example. And this would make sense. As anybody who is a member of any sort of corporation or academia or any organization like that knows full well that real decisions don't get made in front of these huge meetings in which everybody's represented, that the real decisions get made on the periphery. They get made in offices and hallways and places like that. And what the United States very likely is trying to reach for at the present time is some sort of understanding with the two most important operatives in the opposition, which is Russia and Iran. And very likely what they're trying to do is to get more and more issues on the table so that there could be more and more trade-offs that could be made with both Iran and Russia. Iran wants the sanctions lifted. Iran wants some sort of understanding around this nuclear program. Iran wants its sphere of influence in the Gulf. These are things that the United States and Iran can sit down and begin to negotiate in terms of a broader issue, bringing in Syria at the same time. And I think this is a diplomatic strategy that has the most likelihood of actually working.
But the Iranians and the Russians and the Assads have always had their eye on the ball. They've known exactly what they want. They haven't bent one inch. So far, they seem to be winning. What's the incentive for Iran to lean on Syria to make any kind of concessions?
The Gulf, Afghanistan, Iraq, the end of sanctions, a nuclear deal. There's all sorts of things that Iran really wants that are far more important to Syria. You had mentioned earlier about, you know, the Russians and Ukraine, for example. There is all sorts of ways around on the periphery of Russia, in the Caucasus and areas like that, that the Russians consider to be far more important to them than Syria. So understandings can be reached by the United States, by Russia, by Iran, by various other groupings as well within the region. It will not be reached by Saudi Arabia. It will not be reached by other major players on the American side that, you know, feel that Iran is an existential threat. But that's not America's problem at the present time.
But the picture that you painted earlier, James Galvin, of a Syria in which Assad controls most of the coast and Damascus, and then that the rest of the countryside is pretty much controlled by the rebels, is that the future of that country? Could it be viable, partitioned in that way?
No. But we're not talking viability here. What we're talking about is perhaps another Somalia. There are many places on Earth at the present time in which you really do not have effective government over much of the territory of the sovereign state. And so it's very possible that Syria will go down that road as well, which, of course, is an incredible tragedy.
And one that, when we were saying earlier, there doesn't seem to be any real way. Now going back to that, the possibility of a U.S. military action, of course, John Kerry undermined any credibility by talking about an incredibly small strike. But is there, to your mind, a point at which the United States will reach a point where they just are so feel that they've been had so much that they feel like, you know, screw this, let's teach this guy a lesson?
I'm not sure. I don't think it's likely, but of course it is possible. The Kerry remarks, I think, were ill-advised, but they should be interpreted in a very, very specific way, which is that the United States was not going to launch strikes to topple the Assad regime. The United States was going to launch strikes in order to degrade the Assad regime's capabilities. And that would what the United States wanted to do was to tilt the battlefield in a more even direction so that the Assad's forces would not be able to maintain at this point the momentum that it now has. If that occurs, if they see themselves as hopelessly deadlocked, that's the only situation in which they would sit down and negotiate in good faith. If both the opposition and Assad's government, on the one hand, view the situation as hopelessly stalemated on the battlefield, and as well the United States, the Iranians, and the Russians come to some sort of understanding on wider array of issues at the same time, then very possibly there could be a negotiated settlement. But the United States is really betwixt and between here. You know, on the one hand, the fall of Assad, as it presently would be constituted, is not particularly something that the United States would want. The various al-Qaeda forces have been able to take over areas of Syria in the same way that they've been able to take over areas of Yemen and other failed states as well. So this is something that the United States is very, very hesitant about on the one hand. So there's really nothing else it can do but to try to ensure that the soft landing that I had mentioned earlier is reached by, you know, all parties involved.
Well, James Galvin, I thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with James Galvin, who's a professor of history at UCLA. His research focuses on the Middle East, particularly Greater Syria, the area of present-day Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Israel, and the Palestinian territories. And he's the author of Divided Loyalties, Nationalism and Mass Politics in Syria at the Close of Empire, The Modern Middle East, A History. And his latest book is The Arab Uprisings, What Everyone Needs to Know. We're going to take a brief station break and we're back looking into the first makeover of food labels in 20 years.